Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The issues of bioethics continue to expand and deepen all around us. It seems that every time you turn on the television, the radio, pick up the newspaper, you're looking at a fast-breaking controversy having to do with the intersection of life and science, life and medicine, bioethics, as the field is now properly known. One of the leading intellectuals and experts on this, one of the most insightful persons in this field, is Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University. And we're going to have him here for an interview, pre-recorded. And for that reason, we're not going to be taking calls in the midst of that interview, but you're going to be fascinated by the conversation with Professor Robert P. George. It's going to be a classic segment rebroadcast because of current issues, including last week's decision by the United States Supreme Court having to do with partial birth abortion. First, a review of some issues in the news, and in particular, I want to draw your attention to an article I posted just in the last 24 hours at On Faith. That's the project of the Washington Post and Newsweek magazine having to do with the most pressing issues at the intersection of religion and public life in America today. The question for this week at On Faith is this: after 175 years of existence, is Mormonism entering the mainstream of American religious life, or are people still suspicious of it? That question was posted by Sally Quinn and John Meacham, Sally Quinn of Newsweek, John Meacham of Sally Quinn of Washington Post, John Meacham of Newsweek. And this is a fascinating question, and you'll go to the On Faith website and see the number of responses to this. But I want to tell you what I had to say, and I want to tell you why I said what I said. I said several things simultaneously. In other words, when you ask the question, is Mormonism part of the mainstream, you're really asking at least two questions. One is a question about Mormonism. The second is the question about the mainstream. So first, let me deal with Mormonism, and I did this in my article. The question, is Mormonism part of the American mainstream? Well, if we're talking about a theological response, as an evangelical theologian, I have to come back and say that Mormonism is nowhere near the Christian mainstream. As a matter of fact, I can't classify Mormonism as Christian in any sense. It borrows themes and texts from Christianity, but the fact is that what Mormonism teaches in its official doctrines and documents is an absolute contradiction of classical Orthodox biblical Christianity. Just to take a couple of issues. Christianity very clearly teaches what's revealed in the Bible, that God is spirit, not a body. God is not flesh. But according to the Book of Mormon and Mormon doctrine, God is not a spirit, but is a person with a body. The Mormon doctrines deny the historic Christian understanding of the Trinity, of the person and work of Christ, of the doctrine of salvation. Just think about salvation for a moment. Christianity promises salvation through Christ's atonement and the sinner's justification by faith. Mormonism promises deification. Christianity calls for personal faith in Jesus Christ. Mormonism calls for obedience to its own teachings as the path to exaltation. Mormonism replaces belief in the sole authority of the Bible with other writings, especially, of course, the Book of Mormon. Now, that's just a summary of some of the key differences that separate Christianity from Mormonism, but what you end up there is with a great chasm, a tremendous chasm between Mormonism and Christianity. Put simply, Mormonism is not just another form of Christianity. It's a rejection of historic Christianity itself. Now, I have to respond that way as a Christian theologian. And as a matter of fact, I have to respond that way as a Christian theologian before I can respond in any other way. But there is a sociological dimension to this question, isn't there? I mean, because if you're asking about Mormonism in the mainstream, there's a sense in which, even if Mormonism is certainly nowhere near the mainstream of Christian orthodoxy, Mormonism is especially in many parts of this country, especially in the West, very much a part of the mainstream of American culture. I mean, most Americans would be very glad to have Mormons as next-door neighbors. Given the fact that the Mormons idealize and value family values, it is very much the case that Mormonism has moved into the center of American public life, certainly in what might be called middle America, certainly in terms of the suburbs and exurbs of America's cities, certainly in terms of the red states, those more conservative states. Let's face it, a lot of evangelical Christians have come to realize that we vote along with a lot of Mormons on many crucial issues. We understand that we stand together in terms of our understanding of the normative nature of the family. Even where we might not stand together for all the same reasons, The bottom line is that we have much in common there. Now, when you think about Mormons as next-door neighbors, you recognize that even to say the word, even to invoke the name of the movement, is to bring on a certain conception of family values and appreciation for marriage and family structure. So when you look at it that way, Mormons and evangelicals together are concerned with preserving and conserving family values and hold this as a prime concern of both groups. So in that sense, if you're talking about politics and culture in America, you're going to be talking about conservative Christians and you're going to be talking about Mormons in somewhat the same breath. Now, the theology comes first. They're a huge difference. But in terms of many of the social issues, an unusual convergence. But as I said, the whole question about Mormonism in the mainstream, and that's the question posed by the Washington Post and Newsweek this week at the On Faith Project, that whole question not only raises the part about Mormonism, but the part about the mainstream. And I find that very, very interesting. In 1955, the sociologist Will Herberg wrote a book about what he thought was the mainstream of American religious life. His book was entitled Protestant, Catholic, Jew. And by the time Herberg talked about being Protestant and Catholic Jew, he was convinced he had covered the waterfront of the mainstream. Interestingly, when he talked about the Protestant part, he wasn't talking about evangelicals or fundamentalists. He wasn't talking about conservative Protestants. He was talking about the more liberal Protestants that even by the mid-1950s were in those denominations such as the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Disciples of Christ, the Congregationalists, the Lutherans, in the mainstream bodies that eventually, for instance, became associated with the National Council of Churches. Now, that's just a half century ago. What's happened to the mainstream? Well, those liberal Protestant denominations have been hemorrhaging members by the millions. They've been losing membership by tremendous percentages, while evangelicals have been growing. If you look at the year 2005, measured it over against, say, 1955, and you're talking about the mainstream, it's clear that evangelical Christians have moved into the cultural mainstream. Something like 45 to 50, in some polls as many as 60 to 70% of all Americans claim at least to be evangelical Christians. So if we're talking about the mainstream today, yes, culturally and demographically, Mormons would certainly fit into the mainstream in large parts of America, pretty much the same place that evangelical Christians would, the red states, the flyover country, as the elites often say, between the West Coast and the East Coast, Middle America. But here is an interesting angle on that. For how long will this be true? See, evangelicals and Mormons have kind of shared a goal to be in the mainstream. In their own way and for their own reasons, both groups have wanted to be in the mainstream of American culture. But I doubt either will be able to stay there for very long. Because I think as the process of modernity moves forward, as secularism moves forward, as America moves, as it appears to be inexorably moving, in some directions on issues like marriage and sexuality and family, away from what evangelicals and Mormons, for their own reasons, believe, I think it might be the case that looking to the future, it will be difficult to imagine that either evangelicals or Mormons will be in the mainstream of American culture. It's going to be interesting to see because the mainstream is itself a moving target. It's going to be interesting to see because both of these groups, evangelical Christians and Mormons, are going to have enormous, indeed truly enormous fortitude to stand over against the pull of compromise and acculturation that this massively influential society presses upon us. It's going to be interesting to see how evangelicals fare in the midst of this. That's one of my main concerns, even on this program. That's one of the reasons why we do this, is so that intelligent Christians can come together and say, how do we have to think as intelligent Christians so that we do not get co-opted by the culture? I imagine similar conversations must be taking place at, for instance, institutions such as Brigham Young University, in cities like Provo and Salt Lake City, and in places in the West and beyond. I would imagine that there are Mormons asking some of these very same questions. How do we withstand the pressure of this culture? How do we continue to prize, to preserve, and to conserve family values and marriage in a world of no-fault divorce, in a world of consumerist culture that pulls us all into these forces that tend to pull families apart? It'll be fascinating to watch, but it would also be fascinating to hear from you on this question. As you have the opportunity to go to On Faith, you'll see my article, also articles by Chuck Colson and so many others there. You can go to it by going to Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com, and then finding your way to On Faith. Speaking against the challenges of modernity, let me mention to you that the report's coming out of Arkansas that a man there wants $20,000 from his local library, suing them because his two teenage boys discovered and were traumatized by a lesbian sex manual. Earl Adams says his sons, age 14 and 16, were looking for books on military academies when they stumbled across Felice Newman's The Whole Lesbian Sex Book. What they found inside, quote, greatly disturbed the boys, the father said, resulting in, quote, many sleepless nights in our house. Well, Dad and boys, welcome to America in the 21st century, where even the public library is anything but a safe place. This is the safe place for intelligent Christian conversation. Coming back, an interview with Professor Robert P. George. You won't want to miss it. This is the Albert Miller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Moeller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Robert P. George is McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton University, where he also serves as Director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I mentioned at the top of the program, I think he's one of America's leading public intellectuals, a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. I had the opportunity to meet him some years ago. I read everything he writes. I track the stuff that comes out. And this is a man we are honored to have here in the program today. He's also at Southern Seminary right now to deliver the Norton Lectures. And Professor George, it's an honor to have you here on the program.
Well, it's an honor to be on the program, Al, and it's a particular pleasure to be here live and in person in your studio.
Well, this is fun. And, you know, when you start looking at the issues we face today, you really, in a lot of ways, live right in the epicenter of all this.
Well, I must say that the environment in which I spend most of my days is not quite like the environment of Southern Seminary. I live in a world in which most people disagree with what you and I believe, especially about the most fundamental and important moral questions. So I have a lot of fun holding up the side.
You know, those of us who look for conservative intellectuals in America, especially in the Ivy League institutions, think of people like Harvey Mansfield at Harvard and yourself at Princeton. Do you feel like a beleaguered minority? You know, how does that feel in that particular context?
You know, I have to say that I don't. I like to keep on the offensive rather than the defensive. And when you're on the offensive, you don't feel like you're part of a beleaguered minority. We want to move the ball forward at places like Princeton and Harvard. We want to make sure that our students are exposed to the best that's to be said on all sides of an issue, including the conservative side, including the Christian side. Students deserve that, and I certainly intend to make it my mission to make sure that they hear all sides. I wouldn't want it to be a conservative monologue any more than a liberal monologue, but it's been a liberal monologue for too long, and it's got to change, and I take it as my vocation to participate in changing it.
Well, a lot of us are extremely pleased with that, by the way. And, you know, when I look at the fact that you hold the McCormick Chair of Jurisprudence at Princeton University, there's got to be a story behind that. But also, the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. You know, let me tell you, I was reading something the other day written by one of your colleagues at Princeton who said more or less, this is like having a think tank for the enemy right here on the campus. Why would he say that?
Well, the James Madison Program, which we created in the year 2000, we're now in our sixth year, and it's turned into a huge success on the campus, I think has been transforming the debate on political and moral issues on the Princeton campus. We have a number of people associated with the program who are members of the regular faculty, and then there are six visiting fellows, professors from other institutions who come to spend a year with us every year. We have an undergraduate student society that's very active. We have conferences. We have speaker series. And we make sure that all points of view, including conservative and religious points of view, are heard in the debate. And that means that people can no longer assume what they used to assume. People on campus can no longer assume that everybody in the audience, when a speaker's speaking or presentations being made or in classroom discussions, believes the liberal orthodoxies. Those liberal orthodoxies have now been called into question. We've armed our students with the capacity to question those orthodoxies. We ensure that there's a counter point of view that's presented, and it really has had a transformative effect on the campus.
A lot of Americans were kind of awakened to what's going on the college campuses with Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, that was written over 20 years ago. And in the most famous soundbite out of that book, Professor Bloom, now deceased, said, "The one thing every professor knows is that the students in his classroom believe that truth is relative. They no longer believe in absolute truth." You know, you're there on the Princeton University campus. He was writing 20-plus years ago on the University of Chicago campus. Is that still true?
No, I don't think it is. I think it was a wonderful book, and I'm sure what Alan Bloom said about the University of Chicago was true. Certainly, it's true that a lot of students still embrace a kind of moral relativism, including some Christian students who somehow seem to fall into it. But there are an awful lot of students who are open to hearing the other side, open to hearing the arguments for traditional morality, and at least for the idea that there is an objective moral truth. It's pretty easy, once you get the discussion started, to show students that whatever they may profess about their moral relativism, at the end of the day, they're not very relativistic. They don't believe that the question of whether rape is good or bad is a morally relative one. They don't think that whether a woman should be raped is a matter of one culture rather than other than another having a contingent point of view. They actually do think that that's a moral absolute. And if that's a moral absolute, then there have got to be other moral absolutes, and there's just the question of what they are. So we quickly move from a debate about whether there is moral truth to the more important question, what is the moral truth?
You know, in terms of ideas, this is the stuff I swim in, of necessity, trying to understand the mind of the age and the culture. And yet I have to tell you that when I look at the stuff coming out from the academic presses, I'm not so encouraged, you know, and furthermore, you start looking at the dissertations, you start looking at Dissertations Abstract International, which is kind of the yeah. yellow pages of new dissertations coming out. It's hard to find one that, especially in the liberal arts, is not at least indicative of some deep dive into postmodernism and deconstructionism and all the rest. It's hard for me to believe you could get a post in the English department. In a lot of universities, actually believing that Shakespeare had a point about romantic love with Romeo and Juliet, but if you write about it as a subversive text to show the animus against transgendered persons in ancient Verona, you're going to get tenure somewhere. I mean, is that a caricature?
There's a lot of nonsense out there, so it's not a caricature. On the other hand, I have to praise my own graduate students who are doing absolutely terrific work. I've got a wonderful evangelical graduate student right now named Michael Watson, who's about to begin his academic career at Union University. He's finishing up his dissertation on religion and politics with me. He's done a terrific job. I've got another student who's teaching at an evangelical college in New York now, a former graduate student of mine named David Tubbs at the King's College, who has a wonderful book that's about to come out on liberalism's abandonment of concern for children and the incapacity of liberal political theory really to accommodate the needs of children. So there's a lot of good work going on as well. I have to say, Al, I don't think the problem is fundamentally with the students. In my experience at Princeton, the students are eager to learn, they're open-minded, they're willing to entertain an argument and hear a counter-argument. The problem is more on the faculty side.
Well, that's
of things.
Really,
we need to open some minds there.
That's really where I wanted to head, because I was talking to a young man on an Ivy League campus just recently, and he told me, he said, I can have great discussions in the dorm, but I have a very difficult time having any significant discussion in a classroom. Because professors are not open to an awful lot of this. And, of course, that's a generalization, but he said, I have a very hard time having that kind of discussion. But he said, you know, we're living in a time when, you know, most of my buddies in the dorm, and by the way, it's that buddies in the dorm, that's archaic, isn't it? It's a co-ed dorm in most of these places.
Yeah,
there's no
true.
Telling what you're going to face. But he was saying most of the guys that he is hanging around with in conversation, he said they have seen so much harm by the watered down kind of postmodernism that the previous generation kind of imbibed. Many of them, no divorce close at hand. They have friends that attempted or were successful in committing suicide. They've just seen all of this, and they really aren't buying into moral relativism, except, as this guy said, I thought it was very perceptive. He said, except sometimes with their sex lives, where that's the only way they can live with themselves.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. But I do want to stress just how open to argument students are. So if we can get to the students, they'll hear our argument. Now, there's no guarantee that students are going to accept it. We just have to make the argument as best we can, make sure that they understand what's to be said on all sides. I mean, our job as professors is not to indoctrinate, but it is to present the arguments, to empower them to engage the arguments critically, to think hard about them. Also, I think, you know, we are breaking through in a lot of places. I have a wonderful former graduate student, good Southern Baptist named Jack Nowlin, who's professor at the University of Mississippi, just given tenure. So some progress is being made. We're breaking through these screens.
But I have to say, and I say this as a compliment, the very fact that you spoke of your task as something other to indoctrinate is not something that's held by all professors. And I think that's a statement of intellectual integrity. And yet, I do think I see a generation of young people coming who simply aren't going to take whatever's given to them without some serious thought. I hope it takes place in a place and in a context like the Madison program at Princeton University. Folks, the phone number is 877-893-8255. Perhaps you have a question for Professor Robert P. George. A fascinating conversation. We're going to come right back and talk about Professor George and his role in the President's Council on Bioethics. Cutting-edge stuff, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Professor Robert P. George is the author of several books. I want to recommend one to you, and go ahead and write this down. The title is The Clash of Orthodoxies, released in 2002. It's a great book. It really helps to explain an awful lot of what's going on across the culture, from law and politics to bioethics and all the rest. It's available from ISI Books, but all you have to do is go to Amazon, your local bookstore, wherever you go to get books, and ask for The Clash of Orthodoxies by Robert P. George. By the way, just to kind of give you the biographical background, he's a graduate of Swarthmore College and Harvard Law School. He also earned a doctorate in the philosophy of law from Oxford University. He is the professor, the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton University, my guest today on the Albert Mueller Program. You know, Professor George, the first time we met was at a Touch So magazine conference, I guess that was 5 or 6 years ago, something like that. But in terms of an awful lot of the issues that we discussed today, that might as well have been a generation ago. You serve on the President's Council on Bioethics, and I just I get all the material from the council and read it and look at it. But just in the last several months, it's like an entire constellation of issues has arisen that you, I guess, as a council, haven't yet even had much time to consider.
That's certainly right. At this point, cloning is old news, and we're on to new issues. The technology is moving forward very, very quickly, and it's presenting new challenges. I mean, we're now facing the question of animal-human hybridization, creating embryos that are partially human and partially non-human animals. And what do we make of that? We're looking not very far ahead to the question of whether people will try to create embryos, because it will be technologically possible, that have two male parents or two female genetic parents, or more than two parents. So right. An embryo that could then be implanted that would have three biological parents or more. So these are ethical challenges that lie ahead of us. I think we could easily go down some very bad roads toward the dehumanization of human beings, toward the commodification of human life. So it's very important that we put the brakes on.
We talk about embryo ethics on this program a great deal. I don't want to cover all that ground again, but I want to give you an opportunity to say something here in particular. I was all hooked up on the Larry King show in terms of all the electronics and everything. I was in a remote location, and we were actually live watching President George W. Bush the week before 9/11, 2001. Give his address on stem cell research. Mm-hmm. And the reason we were all hooked up is we didn't know what he was going to say. We'd all heard from friends inside the White House and elsewhere what we thought he was going to say. We didn't actually know what he was going to say until he said it. And so we just had to quickly take notes and respond to it. The president's received a great deal of heat on this. As a matter of fact, it's almost an orchestrated campaign among, I think, some who are absolutely determined for various reasons, and I want to leave that open for a moment, to press for just huge, wide-scale, no-restriction embryo research. You're on the President's Council on Bioethics. You support the President's policy.
Yes, I do. I support those aspects of the President's policy that restrict federal funding for embryo-destructive research. I mean, if I had my way, we would in all the states, and if possible at the federal level, ban embryo-destructive research. Destroying human embryos is simply destroying human beings at the earliest stages of their natural development. At the time the president announced this policy, I did have one point of resistance, one point where I did not agree, and that was the permission of the use of embryos that had been destroyed prior to August 9, 2001, when he issued the guidelines. I was afraid that that would create a moral hazard and would lead to the temptation to more embryo killing. I did not take the view that some took, that there was something intrinsically wrong with using the embryonic stem cell lines that had been created from those embryos that had been produced before. I thought the president was right to say that he was putting into place a policy that did not involve any further embryo killing, and you couldn't bring the embryos that were dead back to life. But I was worried about the moral hazard issue and encouraging further embryo destruction or increasing the demand for embryo destruction. But I'll tell you, I've got to hand it to President George W. Bush for standing fast in the face of tremendous hostility, including some from his own party, people like Senator Arlen Specter and others who put tremendous pressure on him to yield. And he
Senator
has not
Orrin Hatch.
And Senator Orrin Hatch, exactly right. Senator Hatch's view is even worse, in that he seems to be in favor of the creation of human life, not only
yes.
the use of the IVF spare embryos, the embryos that are left over, but creation by cloning.
I wanted to set it up so you could answer just the way you did, because when I responded to the president's announcement, I had the same caveat. And by the
yep.
way, your worry is well-grounded. I mean, it wasn't but a matter of weeks until you had persons coming out and saying, well, that's just not enough. We have to have more. And now, from state by state, you even have initiatives in which states are pumping millions and millions of dollars.
That's what I was worried about, exactly.
Into a stem cell industry. Folks, these are the issues that some of you may be tempted to think are being discussed at Princeton University and maybe in the President's Council, but not in your local hospital or in the confines of the family dinner table next door. You'd be wrong. This is where we all live now. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Our guest today is Professor Robert P. George. We'll be back with more conversation in just a moment.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Professor Robert P. George of Princeton University, member of the President's Council on Bioethics, is our guest in the studio today. This has been a fascinating conversation. We were talking about embryo research when we went into the break. And when we come out, I just want to ask this question. And I know how Professor George is going to answer it, but I want you to hear this, because this is the kind of question that I get from men and women on the street. Dr. George, if the most promising avenues of stem cell research, non-embryonic stem cell research right now are coming from, for instance, those taken from amniotic fluid or the umbilicus. If adult stem cells right now are offering the only actual therapies for diseases, why are those zealots to destroy the embryo so, well, zealous in arguing that it simply has to be the destruction of a human embryo that's the only way to get this done?
Well, it is a good question, Alan. People ask me that question as well. Here's the answer. I think there are two things. One, some people on the other side are just dug in. They perceive this as a matter of principle. From their secularist vantage point, they see opposition to embryo-destructive research as an imposition of religious values on them, and they resent it. And so they're doing everything they can to prevail, even if that means casting aside non-embryo-destructive sources of the very same types of stem cells, pluripotent stem cells that they seek from embryos. That's not very laudable, but there it is. The second, I think, is more creditable. I don't agree with it, but it is more creditable, and it's this. It is true that embryonic stem cells provide unique opportunities for doing some basic science, learning about early human development. Now, it's wrong to do it because it involves taking the life of a human being at the earliest stages. But there's a certain area where you can't replicate what could be done with embryonic stem cells using non-embryonic stem cells. We shouldn't be killing human beings to do it, but it is true that when it comes to basic science and perhaps a couple of other uses, non-therapeutic uses, these stem cells are uniquely positioned to use.
I want to offer a third argument.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, and by the way, this is not just by inference. These are serious statements being made in articles published and credible websites among pro-choice organizations, pro-abortion organizations, and all the rest. It basically comes down to, if we ever understand that the human embryo is indeed a human being possessing full human dignity and thus our moral obligation to protect that, then the entire edifice of the abortion complex and everything else starts falling down. And so you start looking at some of this. You know, why are some of the pro-abortion organizations involved in funding stem cell research? It only makes sense if they understand there's a firewall back there that they can't allow to be breached.
Well, I certainly agree with you about that. When you first asked me the question, I was focused on why scientists are making the argument. Now you're talking about the pro-abortion organizations. Here's what I think, and I've thought this for a long time. I can become more persuaded of it every day. That is, the current position, the status quo, will not hold. The outcome of the embryonic stem cell debate will determine whether we make progress toward creating a true culture of life where life is respected in all its conditions and in all its stages, or if we lose, we will be pushed back further in the direction of the culture of death. So this status quo isn't going to hold. Everything's going to depend, when it comes to abortion, for example, and whether it will be more widely promoted or whether it will be cut back to protect innocent life. Everything's going to depend on how we resolve the embryo debate.
I want to ask you a question about the current work of the Council on Bioethics, the President's Council. Are you really going to be able to do much work on human enhancement therapies? Because this is really scary stuff that's coming down the line, really redefining what it means to be human. Just in case folks don't know what we're talking about, it's not only longevity kind of research, but research that that, for instance, would use technology to make the human eye something that it's never been before. It's not just to heal a problem or to return to a situation of operational normality. It's the serious suggestion that we should use technologies to enhance. There's no reason why a runner can't run X number of miles an hour. No reason the human eye can't, eventually have telescopic ability. I mean, this used to be science fiction, Dr. George.
Well, it's still science fiction for the moment. It's going to be a while before we can actually create designer babies. We have plenty of things to worry about that are nearer to us in time, coming right over the horizon, than that. But for the long term, there's no doubt that that is a worry. Now, if I can take an opportunity for a commercial announcement, the President's Council on Bioethics has issued a report, which I think is quite valuable, on genetic manipulations, on enhancement. And that's available, for free at, our website, which is www.bioethics.gov. Gov is G-O-V, www.bioethics.gov. And you can get the report on enhancement there. You can also get our other reports, including our report on human cloning, which I think people will find very valuable. And perhaps even more valuable, our report on alternative sources of pluripotent stem cells that really lays out the case for all the different methods of obtaining exactly the types of stem cells that people are talking about using down the line without killing embryos, without taking human life.
Professor George, where do you derive your worldview?
Christianity, fundamentally, the biblical tradition. I mean, that's but it's a tradition that's itself, of course, shaped by a philosophical tradition. So it's not what theologians call a pure fideist tradition, where we see faith as an irrational source of knowledge or truth. We see faith and reason as, if I can use the analogy of the late Pope John Paul II, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit ascends to the contemplation of the truth. The theological tradition takes within it the philosophical tradition, which means that philosophical arguments can be advanced to vindicate the principles, particularly the moral principles, that we Christians hold. So I would not draw a sharp distinction between faith and reason, and I'm prepared to make the argument against those critics of the Christian worldview on the pure plane of rationality. Nothing would please me more than for us to resolve these questions on the basis of a rational philosophical debate. I don't think their side holds up very well under those types of scrutiny.
And talking about our side, this is the kind of conversation we need to have. My first acquaintance with you was actually at a Catholic institution where we were having a great discussion back and forth about any number of issues, some debate and discussion about how Roman Catholics and evangelicals look at so many issues differently. But, on issues like this, it really is an opportunity for iron to sharpen iron in this kind of discussion, even in terms of what ground of argument we use. You're known as a natural law theorist. In fact, you've helped to redefine natural law theory in terms of the academic debate. You know, at Princeton, do you find a lot of conversation partners in these matters?
Oh, yes, I do. And I think I wouldn't have been appointed and granted tenure and then given the McCormick Chair of Jurisprudence had there not been people who were interested, even if they didn't agree with it or found it not entirely congenial, if there weren't people who were interested in what the tradition has to say. This is a tradition, after all, that not only includes figures like Luther and Calvin, who had natural law ideas, and Aquinas in the medieval period, but going all the way back to the Greeks, to Plato, and especially to Aristotle. It's a rich, rich tradition.
When we come back, I have one final question to ask Professor Robert P. George. One of the most infamous professors at Princeton University is Peter Singer, whom we've discussed several times on this program. I want to ask a fundamental worldview question here. Is there any way, even in a university structure, to bridge the gap of worldviews between a Peter Singer and a Robert P. George? You're not going to miss the answer to that question. We'll be right back.
Is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. When we went into the break, I said I wanted to ask Professor George the question. A question about his colleague at Princeton University, one of the most notorious professors, I think, ever to teach in higher education, Peter Singer, about whom we've said so much on this program, who holds a worldview diametrically opposed to your own. In the American university culture, have we really reached the point where both of these worldviews are supposed to be accommodated?
Well, I'm glad that it's accommodating mine. In too many places, his is accommodated, but the conservative point of view or the Christian point of view or the traditional point of view is not accommodated. So I have to praise Princeton for being willing to at least permit professors to hold worldviews that are contrary to Peter Singer's.
And of course, you can't think of Princeton without thinking about the history of the university. And even among the Ivy League institutions, Princeton has a status that I respect, going all the way back to its founding, and especially with presidents like Jonathan Edwards. And one of the things, for instance, I mentioned is the Christian worldview. We talked about this just a matter of a few days ago. The Christian worldview understands the dignity of science because we believe that the Creator has left us an intelligible world. And we understand the importance of medical science. We're not opposed to medical science. We're certainly not opposed to medical technology. Jonathan Edwards, I think, the greatest theologian of the American tradition, died because he was over-vaccinated with a smallpox vaccine, which he took not to avoid getting smallpox, but to be a moral example to the community about the fact that this was the kind of technology we should use. So when I think about your role at Princeton and the issues you're discussing, you could go back to the revolutionary and the colonial era, and there you had Princeton trying to say, this is the right way medical research should be used. There's nothing wrong with an inoculation and everything right with it in the case of smallpox. But now the issues are just tremendously complex. Professor George, I want you to know how glad I am you're at Princeton University.
Well, thank you very much. I would add that Princeton University also had a president named John Witherspoon, who was a great evangelical minister, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, who played a crucial role in New Jersey's ratification of the Constitution, which made the Constitution possible. He was a great statesman who was not the kind of person who thought that politics and religion had nothing to do with each other, but realized that a good Christian also had to be a good citizen and a promoter of the common good. And I think we have a lesson to learn from Witherspoon today.
Folks, one of the temptations we have is to look at a situation which we know is very troubling and just assume that that there is no hope and there is no means of recovery, and that's fundamentally a non-Christian understanding. We have to look at this understanding that God himself is the ground of our hope, and amazing things do happen. Today, news reports out of Europe that pro-abortion movements really fear what they see as the development of a pro-life movement within Europe, where it hadn't been seen in something like 40 years. A sign of hope for me is Professor Robert P. George at Princeton University, and the fact that, as he said on this program today, there are a lot of students at Princeton who are really open to these arguments. This is the radio program open to intelligent Christian conversation. I'll meet you tomorrow for the same. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.